I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If we think about evolution at all, we probably go back to the 19th century and Charles Darwin and his groundbreaking discoveries about adaptation on the island of Galapagos. But evolution continues, and our guest, Menno Skilthausen, says it's been happening in urban environments all over the world, right in front of our eyes and ears. For instance, blackbirds in European cities have higher-pitched voices than their rural relations. Urban plants create more seeds than plants in the countryside. A certain lizard in Puerto Rico has developed feet that allow them to grip concrete. Crows in Sendai in Japan drop nuts on the street to get cracked by passing vehicles. Skilthausen writes about all of this and more in his new book, Darwin Comes to Town. He's senior research scientist at Naturalists Biodiversity Center, also a professor of evolutionary biology at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Menno Skilthausen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. You know, in many ways, I think of urban environments largely as a threat to animal life. I think of all the birds that fly into tall buildings and, you know, end up on the sidewalks, or even just all the artificial lighting that we have in cities. It just seems like that would make it so difficult for animals and maybe plants, but even animals to survive. Mm. But you're asking us to think very differently about cities.
Well, yes and no. I think it's certainly true that cities are places where there are lots of dangers and challenges for wild animals and plants, but also lots of opportunities. And it's certainly true that many species of animals and plants cannot survive in cities. They cannot find a niche, but the ones that can turn out to evolve and to adapt rapidly to those extreme conditions. Because, of course, indeed, there is a lot of death in cities, but death also results in a few animals that do not die and that do survive, and those are the ones that kickstart an evolutionary process.
What do they, broadly speaking, what do they have to have in order to survive or maybe even thrive in an urban environment?
Well, there are some things that they do need to have to even colonize a city. For example, in birds, being a seed eater helps, because a lot of the food scraps that they eat, human food, are based on seed. Uh-huh. Our food, you know,
lemons, oranges, all of that.
Yeah, but also bread and pizza crusts, and those are all made of seeds. So seed eating birds can feed on that. That helps. Being a species that comes from a more dynamic habitat in the wild also helps things that animals and plants that normally live in floodplains or forest edges that are not very stable, that also change often like cities do, that also helps. But in addition, once they are in the city, you do see that they start adapting in a genetic sense to things like artificial light, to the fact that there's very little soil in the city, the fact that it's hotter in cities because of the so-called urban heat island, and all those things.
Well, I mean, you think about cities, and I mean, this is all very obvious, of course. There's weather, there's extremes of temperature from summer to winter. There's noise, obviously, buildings, building material, different kinds of food. I mean, it seems in many ways that would be an extreme environment. I mean, in many ways, perhaps it is for human beings, but an extreme environment for a lot of plants and animals.
Yeah, it is. I really think that cities are an extreme environment, which also means that animals and plants will need to change quite drastically for them to be able to survive in cities. And not all animals and plants can do that. But when they do, we do really see the evolution of a new ecosystem, an urban ecosystem of species that are predisposed to living in cities and are the sole survivors of the many species that try to colonize cities but fail. And on top of that, evolutionary change to make those species more suited to urban conditions.
Does the urban environment speed up evolution? And I think, again, maybe rightly or wrongly, we think of evolution as happening over time, maybe even over a long period of time. But an urban environment isn't exactly like a rural environment.
No, indeed. In urban evolution can actually proceed quite fast. Darwin thought that it was a very slow process, and I think most people still see it as a very slow process, and it does take time to watch, like, say, a new species or a new group of animal species evolve. But small-scale evolution, the change in the appearance of a species, genetic change, can actually happen very fast, especially if you're talking about animals and plants that have short generation times. Generation time, so that the time between an animal being born and it having its own offspring, when that period is short, then evolution can also take place very quickly, because that's sort of the evolutionary clock speed. At the next generation, you see the effects of natural selection in the generation before.
I mean, can you see it from one generation to a next?
In principle, you can measure it from one generation to the next. The examples that we have of rapid evolution are on the scale of decades. In decades, mm-hmm. you can really, in animals and plants that have at least one generation per year, you can already see observable changes in the way they look and the way they function.
I remember years ago interviewing the author of a book that wrote The Beak of the Finch, which mm-hmm. was about, Wiener was his last name,
yeah.
He got a Pulitzer Prize,
yes.
as a matter of fact, about this research on the Galapagos, about this changing beak of this, you know, these famous finches.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the Beak of the Finch is also a book that's actually one of the first popular science books that explains how evolution can be very rapid and can be measured by people here and now. And the work on the Darwin's finches in the Galapagos Islands is a very good example of, of course, it's the place that we associate with slow evolution over millions of years. But it turns out that you can actually measure evolution mm-hmm. still going on in Galapagos finches on the Galapagos, and people are doing that. And the funny thing is that as I was researching for my book, I realized that even in the Galapagos, there is urban evolution going on. The Galapagos is no longer a completely wild place. There's a fairly large city on Santa Cruz, one of the major islands of the Galapagos. And actually in that city, the Darwin's finches, which were in the process of splitting into two species with different beak shapes because they're adapted to different seeds, are beginning to merge. This process of natural splitting is becoming undone in the city, because all those finches are now urban birds and they eat pizza crusts and breadcrumbs. And they don't need those special beaks anymore.
Well, what we posted on Facebook, a picture of a rat in New York dragging a piece of pizza down mm-hmm. the step.
Yeah.
It's kind of an infamous or famous video of, I guess, animals surviving in our environment. Let's talk about the white-footed mice, which are in different locales in New York, in some New York parks.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that you see in cities which is different from natural environments is that the habitat, the vegetation is usually very much fragmented in cities. It's split up into parks, gardens, and even smaller patches of vegetation. And animals and plants that survive in those patches of vegetation are completely, they're like in an archipelago of islands.
Wow.
So you could say that the parks in New York are like the Galapagos archipelago, but then in a city.
Even within, let's say, a park that's a block by a block by a block, size?
Yeah, if those blocks are really a barrier to animals like the white-footed mouse, which is a native rodent in East Coast North America. Those mice were there, of course, before the city was built hundreds of years ago. They were roaming free through the forest, which was continuous. And now the remains of that vegetation are separated into fragments. And the mice that are still living there are isolated. They're marooned in these patches of vegetation. And it turns out, through research done by Jason Munshie South, a colleague of mine working at Fordham University, that these white-footed mice that are now isolated are becoming adapted, genetically adapted to the conditions of their local park. So in some parks, like Central Park, which is visited by 25 million people per year, there's a lot of human food that these mice eat. And Jason has discovered that the chromosomes of these mice are evolving to deal with fatty diets, with human food.
Oh, with our Mickey D's and all of that.
Exactly, yeah. And in other parks,
is this a different species? Are we seeing different than species of mice within one park?
It's the same species. We would still consider it the same species, but every population in a different park of that particular species is changing its genetic makeup. because of adaptation to the local park conditions.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Menno Skilthausen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book called Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. And he is a evolutionary biologist at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And you can join us, as I said, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I do want to talk about some more animals, but I do want to also just make note of something that you write in this book, that in the year 2000, the world, at least as far as humans are concerned, there are more people living in urban areas than rural areas. Yeah. This happened in 2007. So more and more, we're all living in a more urbanized environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are. And by the middle of this century, that proportion is going to be even higher, around two-thirds of the Earth's population, which by then will probably have grown even more, will be living in cities. So cities are expanding, and whether we like it or not, they're going to be a major habitat for of the world's surface. It's a very artificial habitat, but it turns out that it's still some sort of habitat for animals and plants. So it's really something that we need to take into account if we want to predict the biodiversity of the future.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because I could see someone say, I mean, and it's makes sense. We need to go back. We need to go back to a more rural environment because urban environments, they're not good for people. I'm overstating things a little bit here. Mm-hmm. They're a threat to plants and animals, and could take this argument to say, if animals and plants are adapting to this environment, then let's just keep building more impervious streets.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's cities are never going to be a place where the bulk of biodiversity can survive. As I mentioned before in this hour, the kinds of animals and plants that can survive in cities are they're very specific species of animals. They're not that many of them, and they need to adapt in order to survive in the cities. So on the one hand, I think we should be aware of and actually appreciate the process of this evolution of a completely new global urban ecosystem. On the other hand, we still need pristine areas to be protected to preserve all the other species that cannot survive in those artificial environments. So you can, as far as I'm concerned, you can do both. You can preserve untouched areas and at the same time value and study the evolution of biodiversity in those very much touched areas.
So we don't have to pick or choose. We need both.
Yes, we do.
Let me see what John, looks like John from Claymont, Delaware has to say. And John, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, yes, I was particularly intrigued with, you mentioned mice involving so that they can handle their fat cells changing.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about, like, you know, not to be a speciesist, but any changes in the human species, and like, say, for example, might like say autism be an example?
Well, John, let me take your broad question there. I mean, I'm assuming if animals, are evolving, so are we.
Well, yeah, in principle, cities are to humans just as extreme an environment as they are to the animals and plants that live in cities, because we also did not evolve to live in such large concentrations of people in such artificial environments. So I think for some reasons you could expect this urban era also to be an important stage in our evolution. First of all, because there's so many of us that if there's any moment in the history of our species in which new mutations are appearing, it's now, because there are so many people and you need people to have those new mutations, those new mutants. On the other hand, of course, there's not that much for evolution. You need what they call differential survival. You need that having one characteristic makes a person survive better or have more children. And that's a bit harder to imagine in humans than in a house sparrow or a starling, because they actually die by the numbers when they're hitting glass or eating polluted food and things like that. It's not really happening so much in people at the moment, fortunately. So evolution may not be that easy in people. Although there is some evidence from actually from earlier stages in our urban past of the very early cities in the Middle East, people have done research on skeletons buried there, and they've seen that in those urban populations already thousands of years ago, there was evolution going on of immune genes, because in cities there's much more infectious diseases that can spread very easily. And of course, that's something that even modern humans are not completely immune to. A new disease will still kill people. But you do need differences in death and survival to make humans evolve. And at the moment, in cities, most people are surviving.
Well, let's talk about plants. And, mm-hmm. and you write about, I don't know if these are plants that have adapted to an urban environment or a very specific kind of plant, that they create more seeds and perhaps even more different kinds of seeds, because mm-hmm. it's got to get into the cracks in the sidewalk, for instance.
Yes. I've mostly talked about animals so far, but there's also many examples of plants that are evolving in cities, and one of them is hawksbeard, it's called in English, if I'm not mistaken. It's a plant from Southern Europe, which lives in cities in Southern Europe. And this plant and many related plants also, they produce two kinds of seeds, very heavy ones, which fall straight to the floor, and very light ones with a little parachute that float away on the drift away on the wind. And in natural conditions, those are two very good strategies, because the heavy ones will fall down to the soil where the parent is growing. The light ones may colonize new areas, which are also likely to be found. But in cities, that latter strategy actually doesn't work very well, because these drifting seeds will most likely fall on tarmac or concrete and not germinate. So in cities, those heavy seeds are actually the best strategy. Mm. And people in France, researchers in France, are discovering that indeed in cities, that particular species of plant is producing more of those heavy seeds, because they're the best strategy on getting offspring, because these plants grow in like little patches of soil around trees that are planted along the streets. And their offspring cannot germinate anywhere else but in those small patches.
Does that change the definition of native plants then? So what is a native plant?
It does. I mean, in a sense, you could argue that many of the non-native plants that you find in cities, and especially plants, are the flora of cities are very non-native. More than half of the species that you find in a city are often from elsewhere. But once those non-native, those introduced species of plants start evolving and adapting to the local conditions, at least those adaptations become native. So they are no longer the same as they were when they started invading.
I'm thinking about kudzu, which I don't know if you know about kudzu, but and we're almost up in a break here, but that just can massively take over an area.
Yeah. And there are many other plants like that in different parts of the world. And those tend to be urban plants and very good at colonizing cities and those disturbed habitats that we create.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Menno Skilthausen is our guest. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's also the author of a new book called Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. We're going to talk more about some of these extraordinary adaptations of plants and animals, and also what it means for our evolution, for our own adaptation. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. What have you observed in your ecosystem? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen talking with evolutionary biologist Menno Skilthausen about how our fast-paced, crowded cities are shaping, even accelerating, animal and plant evolution. And to survive things like noise and smog and traffic and light and heat of our urban jungles, wildlife has had to adapt and in many ways adapt quickly. Of course, and this doesn't work for every plant and animal. Our guest has been studying how cities are driving natural selection all over the world. We talked about the mice in New York, spiders in Vienna, mosquitoes in London. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I was really shocked and surprised and just intrigued to learn in the London subway system, depending on which line you take, there's a different, species of mosquito?
Different kind of
mosquito. And I was reading a description of you with your, some kind of a spyglass looking at the walls of a subway to determine what's going on.
Yeah, there's, it's always a bit strange to do biological stuff in a very urban environment.
Exactly.
Field work as an urban ecologist can be very surprising to many passersby. But one of the things you can find in the London Underground is, and actually in most undergrounds, metropolitan undergrounds in the world, is a species of mosquito called Culex molestus, the nomen est omen, you could say. Which is probably a species of mosquito that has evolved very recently, in the last few hundred years, few thousand years maybe. Actually, as soon as people started constructing underground spaces to dwell in. So it did not evolve in the London Underground, but it is living there. And the nice thing is that in the London Underground, actually on top of that evolutionary process that has led to this underground mosquito, you see that even within different subway lines, the mosquitoes, because they're isolated from each other, these trains are just constantly pumping the mosquitoes around in one subway line, and they're not mixing unless they would change trains at Oxford Street station, which they don't. So you get this, you could say different kinds, different types of the Culex molestus mosquito in different subway lines.
And it was just adapting to whatever that environment is?
Probably, yeah. This is research that was done more than 20 years ago. So it was measured that they do have genetic differences in different subway lines. But what those genetic differences mean, we don't know. But presumably, at least some of them have to do with the special conditions, maybe the temperature that is different in different lines. The deeper ones may be hotter than the ones more close under the surface, etc.
We have Gary from Malvern who writes in an email, I can tell you that in my area of suburban Philadelphia, there are at least two species doing very well adapting to our human environment. Flocks of Canada geese treat our corporate parks like resorts. I have a family of raptors loving my apartment complex for all the fat squirrels that they feed on. I don't know if it's true in the Netherlands, but deer now live in the suburbs, I think attracted to our gardens and lawns and things like that. Is that what you're talking about?
It is in a sense. There are many different processes going on. One of them is that more species are starting to colonize cities than before. Cities are becoming more wildlife friendly because the larger mammals and birds don't get prosecuted, like those deer and foxes in Europe and coyotes in Chicago. They don't get shot as easily as they do in the countryside or killed by traffic or otherwise. So that's one reason.
You're saying it's actually safer for them in a more urban environment.
For many animals, that's true. There's also it's also warmer during the winter in more temperate regions. There's food available throughout all the seasons because people really concentrate food in cities. There's always something around for animals. So there's many reasons why cities could be becoming places that are more and more attractive for animals and even plants to colonize. And once they colonize cities, then we start seeing these evolutionary processes that over time they really genetically adapt to whatever conditions are special to cities.
You write about coyotes, wolves, bobcats. I mean, these are all bears, coming in, coming into more peopled environments, I would say. But I guess from the human perspective, it feels like you're going to have more interactions with quote-unquote wild animals.
Yes. Yeah, that's certainly true. So human-wildlife conflict or at least interactions are becoming more common, which sometimes is bad for the people, but usually is good for the animals. I mean, in the sense that many animals that are somewhat intelligent, that can really let's say, read our minds, interact with us in a behavioral way. Mm. They're really using their mental faculties to try to understand how people work and try to make use of us. So we're also seeing that many birds and mammals that are like raccoons, like starlings, like parrots, they're learning to come up with solutions to get more food out of us. And they, of course, human food is often packaged in a certain way. And many wild birds, for example, that live in cities are evolving, literally evolving their intellectual capacities to be better at problem solving, to be better at opening
lids of bottles, right?
Lids of bottles, for example. I mean, that's a famous example of birds in England that have learned to open bottles of milk and scoop up the cream from the inside of the bottle. And there are many examples like that.
You write about, I mentioned this in the introduction, about certain birds. I think it was in a city in Japan.
Yes.
You know, dropping nuts on the ground.
Yeah.
I guess figuring, well, the traffic. I mean, I'm getting into the head of the bird, obviously, but that the traffic breaks open the nuts and then
exactly.
they get to eat inside.
Yeah.
So what is that a sign of?
Yeah, it's the example of the crows in Japan that are using now traffic to crack walnuts for them. You could say that's not evolution. They're just learning a trick which they're passing on to each other. That's certainly true. There's not a gene for putting nuts in front of cars' wheels. But there are genes for being inventive. There are also genes for problem solving. There are genes for being curious. Those are personality-changing genes that are changing and evolving in populations and that can make these urban crow species more predisposed to finding out tricks to make use of human food. Mm. And that's probably what's happening, that the personalities of these animals are evolving.
And they are problem solvers.
Yeah, yes.
A couple of just basic evolutionary questions. One from Francis: how much of evolution is strictly up to chance or good luck? Also, let me get Kathleen from Ambler, and she has a sort of a basic question about natural selection. And Kathleen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm curious about the reason that the day I was born, for example, using that day as a starting point for the conversation in my question, there were more boys likely born the day I was born, but over the course of my lifetime, men die, and so today there are fewer men than there are women alive who were born on the day I was born. So
right.
Why is that naturally selected for?
And is that natural selection? Is that evolution, Menno, or is that the fact that men have more dangerous jobs, they go to war?
Mm-hmm.
There's more violence.
There is in humans and other species where one sex, one gender, or at least one genetically determined sex has a greater chance of dying early in life. You do see that there is some mechanism by which the sex ratio is skewed a little bit in favor of the sex that dies earliest. So even though basically humans have a 50-50 ratio of boys and girls being born, you do see that there are slightly more boys mm-hmm. being born. That is probably an evolutionary adaptation to the fact that this sex ratio changes over life with women usually surviving longer right. than men. So that is definitely an evolutionary change. And in other species where that shift is even greater, you also see that the offset is greater.
You see that also in animals?
Yes.
The same thing that Kathleen was talking about?
Yeah. Yes, you do.
Interesting. Kathleen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You have studied mating behavior, anatomy, all that, how that has adapted to our changing world. How have cities changed mating behavior among animals?
Well, it depends a bit on what the animal uses for its mating behavior, for its courtship. One of the things that has been studied extensively is the sounds that animals make, that birds make, bird song, which male birds, of course, use to attract females and to compete with other males to defend their territories. Those songs are actually changing in cities because of the noise we see in, we hear in cities. There's always a lot of background noise produced by people, and those noises are usually low frequency, sort of a background rumble that is constantly there. You may not even realize it anymore when you're walking in the city, but when you listen carefully, there's always some noise in the background. And we see that birds are changing the pitch of their songs to a higher frequency to rise above that background noise. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's a learned behavior. They don't really evolve a different song type. But in some cases, there's also evidence this is actually evolution, that there are genes for the songs that they sing, and those are also evolving in cities.
How about things like plumage? I mean, does that mm-hmm. also change
yeah.
mating behavior?
Or yeah, this has also been studied in birds, in for example, the dark-eyed junco, which is a bird from California, which has colonized cities. And originally, these birds live high in the mountains where there is only a very short season that they can breed. So they can just raise one nest and they need to defend that. And for the defense, they use displays of white feathers in their tails. But in the cities, which are at sea level, they can start breeding in February already and they can have 3 or 4 nests per year. So actually defending a territory is not so important anymore. So the birds, the females, are not so interested in selecting males that have these white feathers anymore because they don't need those displays to defend their territories.
Isn't evolution amazing?
It is.
I mean, do you still find it amazing, just thrilling in a certain kind of way?
Yes, yeah.
And kind of a lock and key?
I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is that cities and the rapid evolution that we see in cities is even to me so fascinating for the fact that it happens so quickly and the fact that we can just observe it going on around us in our backyards, literally.
Let me see what Roger from, looks like Upper Chichester, has to say. And Roger, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
First of all, I find this very interesting and very intriguing. But I've noticed we have a tendency to kind of focus on the things, and we study the things that we can see and that are more accessible.
Yes.
Obviously, ocean acidification is a serious issue, and I saw a couple interesting documentaries on coral bleaching and everything. Mm-hmm. So I was curious if, in your field of work, if you've noticed any kind of adaptations under the sea, if, you know, corals have been able to adapt to, you know, these highly acidic environment that they're in, or even, you know, anything like on the ocean floor,
sure.
because we're much less likely to, you know, get down there and mm-hmm. be able to study it.
Roger, yeah. I appreciate the call. I mean, you're an urban evolutionary biologist. Are there some connection you think with?
There probably is. Yes, there are certainly some people working on the impact of urban conditions on the marine life in cities that are located on the seaside, where, and especially in the tropics, where you often have coral reefs right in front of these cities. And there is siltation, there is pollution, there's acidification, there's all kinds of reasons why the marine life there is suffering from the fact that there is a city nearby. I don't actually know of anybody studying evolutionary change in marine organisms because of that. But I think it's a matter of time before people start doing that. And I really agree that that's certainly something that is likely to take place.
Let me segue from that to a section that you write about PCBs. We mm-hmm. know that there's, as you described, this chemical cocktail that's in
yes.
our environment. And we try to eradicate that or certainly limit that. But you are also saying that there are certain adaptations to salinity
yeah.
in PCBs.
Yes. There are pollution in the sludge in harbors, for example. There's actually a very nice study has been done on killifish, which are sort of freshwater, brackish water fish that live in estuaries and also estuaries around cities where there has been a lot of pollution from industry. Especially in the second part of the 20th century, there were these PCBs released, and they're very persistent. They
yeah.
stay in the mud for a long time, and they interfere very much with the development of animals. And in some of those places, it turns out that those killifishes have evolved mechanisms in their biochemistry that allows them to survive in the face of these very high, very toxic levels of PCBs. It turns out that they've done that independently in different harbors and in a very, very clever way, you could say. They've basically taken out a few what we thought were essential cogwheels in their developmental process, and they've bypassed those places in that system that are sensitive to PCBs.
We're almost out of time here, but do you worry about our environment and our ability to adapt? And by our, I mean everything.
Mm-hmm. I do.
In 20 seconds or less. Sorry about that.
I'm of course, as a biologist, I'm really fascinated by diversity, and I realize that in our human-shaped world, only very little biodiversity can survive. But I do worry about the rest of biodiversity that's living outside of cities, and I really think we need those pristine areas protected to preserve most of the biodiversity.
Well, Menno Skilthausen, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. And he's speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University in conversation with WHYY's Mike and Scott of The Pulse. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.